Welcome to the Press On Podcast. In this episode, we'll hear from Hazel McAfee on the first century Jew.
I remember, many years ago, seeing a nativity set with a little black African, Mary and Joseph and baby Jesus, and thinking, rather condescendingly, what a shame they can't see beyond the narrow confines of their own culture. Of course, the Holy Family didn't look like that. But over time, my thinking changed, and when I saw such scenes, little Peruvian characters in ponchos and pigtails, or cute Russian babushkas, or Japanese figures, it was more, how brilliant that these different nationalities adopt Jesus as their own. What's more, I came to see my own early reaction as both arrogant and judgmental, because haven't we too adapted our image of Jesus to fit with our own preconceived ideas and our notion of the world? You only have to look at the pictures in our illustrated Bibles and famous paintings to see a European Jesus. Pale skin, golden hair, blue eyes, manicured nails, freshly laundered, beautifully draped clothes, perfectly prepared for a photo shoot. And that led me to wondering just how far beyond mere appearance our perceptions are distorted. After all, we're perceiving the biblical words and actions at a distance of many centuries, from an entirely different culture, in a different language, filtered through the prejudices and biases of many interpreters. There's an absolutely massive literature on the subject of the historical Jesus out there, and I'm indebted to many writers and speakers for their scholarship and wisdom. I've only scratched the surface of it, but my hope is that by dipping into a limited number of aspects of Jesus which we might have misunderstood, our picture of him will emerge more solid and robust, and that it will spur us all on to continue seeking for him. Because the most important aim is not to accumulate knowledge per se, but to find ways of following him more nearly. Let's start at the beginning, his birth. I guess we all know that the stories about his birth are essentially romanticised and sanitised. But do we recognise how far out of alignment with reality they are? And this is more than there was no donkey, no halos, no angels with glittery wings. Renowned scholar Kenneth Bailey, using his intimate acquaintance with life in the Middle East, coupled with his immense biblical knowledge, gives a vivid explanation of why the common images are erroneous. For example, he says, there was no inn. It would have been a private home, probably two-bedroomed with a guest room, and that was the room that was not available. This baby would be born in the main, less private room, closer to the animals. So, no innkeeper or wife. There go two stalwarts of the Christmas plays. The house would have been similar to those that lowly shepherds lived in. If it were too grand, the shepherds would have felt intimidated. If substandard or unsuitable, they would have invited the family to stay in their own homes. Such was the custom in this land where hospitality was so important. And because hospitality was sacrosanct at that time, no one would have turned away Joseph, a descendant of King David, especially not in the city of David, Bethlehem. Nor would they have failed to help a pregnant woman. Besides, Mary and Joseph were there some days before the birth, according to Luke 2, so they could have gone to relatives Elizabeth and Zechariah, who lived nearby. Now, if we go back and read the birth accounts in Matthew and Luke, we'll see just how little information is actually given, and yet vivid images have been created, which we have perpetuated. It's all part of this erroneous picture we have of who Jesus really was. In reality, though, if we throw away all the frills and furbelows, we have, at the centre, a baby born in the same way as most babies, to most probably a very young teenage mum, unmarried if you listen to Luke, married in name only if you go by Matthew, into an impoverished little family of soon-to-be refugees. What, then, can we say about this baby? We know from the recorded genealogies in Luke 3 and Matthew 1 that he had dubious credentials and few advantages. Yes, his ancestry is traced back to illustrious characters like David and Abraham, but 5 women are named in Matthew's list: Tamar, Rahab, Bathsheba, Ruth, and Mary, all with irregular sexual histories. 4 not born Hebrews, but incorporated into the community through marriage. The stigma of illegitimacy seems to have clung to him even in adulthood and was thrown at him periodically by his critics. Scholars believe that when he was referred to as the son of Mary, as in Mark 6, it was a deliberate slur at a time when lineage was exclusively through the father. And the religious leaders in John 8 employed a veiled reference to the rumours with, "We are not illegitimate children." So, no flawless pedigree, nor ancestors who were totally morally virtuous. Not a flying start, you might think. No tangible advantages. But as we know, symbolic of the person he was to become. And I personally find this brings him much closer than any elitist and impeccable royal line would have done. So what of his childhood? The Bible tells us very little of it, so we need to look to other sources to get a picture of what a country lad of his time would have experienced. The biblical silence leaves too much scope for glossing over the years of training he had for the task ahead, the hard times he lived in. But the more we understand, the more rounded the character of Jesus becomes. So, what of his childhood? The Bible tells us very little of it, so we need to look to other sources to get a picture of what a country lad of his time would have experienced. The biblical silence leaves too much scope for glossing over the years of training he had for the task ahead, the hard times he lived in. But the more we understand, the more rounded the character of Jesus becomes. The young Jesus grew up in Nazareth, a small peasant village or town in Galilee, only 4 miles from Sepphoris, the largest city in Galilee and the centre of Herod's administration. Mary and Joseph were poor. They couldn't afford a lamb for sacrifice at the temple, offering instead a pair of doves or young pigeons. So home would have been very basic. The synagogue was the centre of Jewish life at that time. All the community who were free to do so, men and women, would go there. So they heard the Torah read aloud every week. We know that some groups of workers, for example shepherds, were rather looked down on because they couldn't attend regularly. Their work made them ritually unclean. Given what's known about first century practice, by the time he was 5 or 6, the young Jesus would be beginning to learn to read and memorize the written Torah, our Pentateuch, and much of the Hebrew scriptures, which by now included the Psalms and the prophets. We're talking about the parts we tend to skim over and certainly don't expose our small children to. Imagine asking your 5-year-old to learn Leviticus. I suspect most lads wouldn't know Deuteronomy as anything more than the old shaggy grey feline in the musical Cats. After 10, the boy would begin to learn the oral Torah, explanations and refinements handed down to help interpret the written Torah. And if you've ever read the detail and nitpicky instructions, imagine giving that to your 10-year-old to learn. However, it wasn't perhaps quite as astonishing as we might be thinking. We're so used to books and computers and modern technology that our brains balk at what these children faced. But back in the first century, oral traditions prevailed. They learned most by listening and watching others do things, how they lived, their attitudes. And it was the same with the older students, watching and listening and learning by observing their teachers and rabbis closely. As the eldest of his generation, Jesus himself would be acutely aware of the impact of his own behaviour on his siblings and the importance of setting a good example. The most talented boys were encouraged to continue studying at the synagogue until they married at 18 to 20. Only the most brilliant would go on to become disciples of a great rabbi. But by 13, most lads would have concluded their formal study of the Torah and started to learn a trade. Between 13 and 30, then, Jesus was most likely working as a builder, carpenter by day, and joining a discussion group at night to study the law within a lay movement that grew up during that time in the villages of the Holy Land. Imagine hard physical labour for long hours and then poring over numbers when you're physically weary. We sometimes quail at the thought of listening to a talk on a weekday after a comparatively genteel day, don't we? And Jesus couldn't opt out of the hard labour just because his mind was on a higher plane. He was living in a world of poverty and high mortality with many orphans and widows. His contribution would be really important to this humble family. But by this means, going to a kind of evening class, he would have a further 17 years of theological education, giving him the skills of a rabbi. And he was clearly an excellent student. It would take a very competent child of 12 to hold his own with the learned men in the temple and amaze them with his understanding and answers. A special little snippet about his youth we do have recorded for us in Luke 2, where we read, "His parents found him in the temple courts, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking questions. Everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding and his answers. When his parents saw him, they were astonished." And his intimate knowledge of the law and the prophets and Psalms is very evident throughout his teaching. So what of the family? We might be thinking, model son, obedient and dedicated, all would be harmony and joy. We know from Luke 2, the boy grew in wisdom as he grew in stature and strength. Verse 51 also specifies that he was obedient to his parents after the escapade in the temple. Family ties were really important in Jewish culture, and we can picture Jesus as a child very much embedded in his own family, absorbing information and wisdom from Mary as well as Joseph. He'd listened to stories from infancy up, because the Jews of the first century also had a strong tradition of passing on tales of their ancestors, as in the Passover story. So he would acquire a robust sense of his Jewish identity. However, though family was important at that time, we get glimpses that in his case, Jesus' allegiance was somewhat divided between his human and divine parents, and I sometimes wonder how his mother felt hearing and seeing him in these situations. As we've just seen, he corrected her specifically at 12 in the temple. And he did so again at the wedding celebrations in John 2, where he said, "Dear woman, why do you involve me? My time has not yet come." He said his mother and brothers were those who did his father's will, Matthew 12. When he was told that his family were outside the house where he was teaching, wanting to speak to him, he pointed to his disciples and said, "Here are my mother and my brothers, for whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother." As a mum, I'd struggle if my son dismissed my importance in this way. When the locals wondered aloud how a man whose family they knew personally acquired such wisdom, learning, and healing powers, his response was, "Only in his hometown and in his own house is a prophet without honour. And he did not do many miracles there because of their lack of faith." Even his own brothers didn't believe in him, as we read in John 7, and indeed thought he was mad in Mark 3. Put these together and you get an uneasy tension in the family. What then of his appearance? We know intellectually he was an Aramaic-speaking, circumcised Jew from the early first century, but as we said at the outset, we often create him in our own image. We see him through the glasses of our world, our culture, our values, without intending to, or perhaps even without being aware we're doing it. And worse, we sometimes use him to rubber stamp values and ideas he wouldn't have believed in, 21st century problems unknown in his day. So let's try to rectify that. We certainly need to jettison that ethereal image of a handsome Adonis just stepped out of the shower in bleached white clothes with an aura of light around him. But how would we feel about the actual dusty flesh and blood man who trudged the streets of Galilee, I wonder? Would he be so appealing? If he strolled by our place of work, would we have left all to follow him? Picture then a swarthy, olive-skinned man, probably not very tall, since the average age of men at that time was 5'5". He'd be wearing a linen undergarment or tunic, the one that was gambled for at the cross, recorded in John 19. In his case, we know this garment was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom, which is thought to signify priesthood. Over that would be an outer woolen garment, a rectangular mantle worn in public at all times and used as a blanket for sleeping, but not the striped prayer shawl that came later. The hems of these outer garments symbolised the status of the wearer. But this man wasn't high status. Does this fact disturb us? Do we bother with such things generally? At the corners of the garment, there'd be tassels, as instructed in Numbers 15, where it says, "You will have these tassels to look at, and so you will remember all the commands of the Lord and will be consecrated to your God." You'll remember the woman in Matthew 9 grasped the tassels on Jesus' robe and was healed. His open sandals would have been leather and probably homemade, dusty and worn like his feet. I had to smile wryly at this point, remembering those worthies who've insisted on suits and ties and polished shoes for Sundays. and I've seen many a cartoon showing a sandaled Jesus left out of a church along with a tramp or a homosexual person. But I've walked alongside people who have little choice of clothes, and I've taken on board a salutary message. Who do we think we are to dictate and enforce man-made rules? What gives any of us the right to control or even close the door on another person seeking a relationship with God? Perhaps if we meet this more grounded figure honestly, it will help us act more like him too. In reality, he also almost certainly wore tefillin, small black boxes containing scriptural passages, on his arms, although I've yet to see them depicted anywhere. He was probably wearing them discreetly when he criticised those who were wearing large phylacteries prominently on their foreheads to advertise their superior piety and social status. In Matthew 23, where it says, "Everything they do is done for men to see. They make their phylacteries wide and the tassels on their garments long. They love the place of honour at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues." What of language? Jesus spoke the language of the country people he lived amongst, Aramaic, using illustrations and expressions they would immediately recognise. And he used forms of speech which would all be familiar to his listeners too, and understood quite differently from the way we hear them. We wouldn't today talk about demon possession when we mean ill people. We don't structure our stories as encased parables or parallel thoughts. And it'd be a foolhardy person who started calling church leaders hypocrites and brood of vipers. So we need to exercise care when we attribute meaning to the translations in the gospel records without first understanding prevailing customs and practice. It's all too easy to select the words and meanings that suit our purposes and conveniently argue others away. Human emotions. We don't often think about what went on inside Jesus, do we? But gather together all the biblical accounts, and we can see there plenty of evidence that he was subject to very human emotions. And again, I personally find this enormously reassuring. When it says he was tempted in all points like us, I've previously thought about some of my experience, which he certainly wouldn't have shared. But when I listed the emotions he showed, then I identified with him more and more. He would understand my reactions from his own first-hand experiences. He was clearly an enormously charismatic figure whom people flocked to, and he easily engaged with people across the social spectrum, from the woman at the well to Zacchaeus, from fishermen to the rich young man, from the religious elite to children. And pervading these encounters is a kindness, a sensitivity that reached out to the underprivileged and outcasts who were treated badly by other men. And I'm thinking here of lepers, as in Luke 17, the hemorrhaging woman in Mark 5, the blind beggar in Luke 18, and the underclasses like women and disabled people. One aspect of his character we don't often think about is his sociability. He partied, drank, went to several day weddings, dined with tax collectors and Pharisees, and he would have joined in the traditional Jewish celebrations, the Feast of Purim, Passover. When I was growing up, many modern forms of entertainment were frowned on. We were told Imagine being at that venue or engaged in such and such an activity when Jesus returns. It never occurred to me then that Jesus himself would probably join in the party, dance, have a glass of wine. However, life was by no means one long party for him. He felt, and could express, deep sorrow and distress, weeping over Jerusalem in Luke 19, and when Lazarus died, John 11. Both individuals with illnesses and crowds moved him and generated compassion or pity in him. And of course, he suffered agony in the Garden of Gethsemane, Matthew 26, Luke 22, where we read, "And being in anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground." And just as he was in touch with his own emotions, he showed empathy and support for those around him. He commended those who showed great faith before healing, Mark 5, Matthew 29, and praised Nathanael, who was without deceit, John 1. He called Peter, in spite of his failings, his rock, in Matthew 16, and promised the woman with spikenard her story and generosity would be told forever, Mark 14. But for me, perhaps his humanity comes through most powerfully when he showed negative emotions. We see his righteous anger and exasperation directed at the money changers in the temple in Matthew 21. The hypocrites who were indignant when he healed on the Sabbath, Luke 13 and Mark 3. The Pharisees in the list of woes in Matthew 23, and the lawyer who tried to intercede for the Pharisees in Luke 11. Even his closest disciples drew stern reproofs, cowards with too little faith in Matthew 8, perverse and unbelieving when they couldn't cure the epileptic boy in Matthew 17, even Satan in Matthew 16. He rebuked them when they tried to turn away little children in Matthew 19, and when they offered to call down fire on inhospitable villagers in Luke 9. I find it very sobering to imagine myself on the receiving end of his reproof, realizing that I could be described as doing the modern equivalent of many of these things. My faith is often too little. I can be perverse and hypocritical. Just imagine those disappointed eyes looking straight at you. No wonder Peter went out and wept bitterly when that happened to him. On the other hand, I love Jesus' sense of humour. Laughter is restorative amidst all the seriousness. The camel going through the eye of a needle in Matthew 19. The man with a plank in his eye trying to remove a speck from his brother's eye in Matthew 7 are such graphic and compelling images. The fun but pertinent nicknames for the disciples give us a sense of a twinkle in our Lord's knowing eye. Our picture is of a man constantly surrounded by people, drained to the dregs by the constant giving of himself. And it's moving to see his vulnerability. He wasn't just floating serenely above all the noise and demands. He felt a deep need for solace and sustenance. It drove him to rise very early in the morning, while it was still dark, to go off alone to a solitary place in order to pray, Mark 1, Luke 5. And yet, he really, really craved human companionship, as in the Garden of Gethsemane, asking his disciples repeatedly, to watch with him and pray. Matthew 26. I'm not at all sure I would have been any more sensitive to his personal need for either solitude or support than they were. But I feel more drawn to him, knowing he experienced those relatable emotions. So, what can we conclude? We can tend to wrap the figure of Jesus in sacred packaging because we know who he was and what he did, and because we know the end of the story. And because we aren't familiar with life at that time, his behaviour can seem idiosyncratic and part of his otherworldliness to us. But, as Kenneth Bailey again says, I can no more understand Jesus apart from his Jewishness than I can understand Gandhi apart from his Indianness. I need to go way back and picture Jesus as a first century Jew with a phylactery on his wrist and Palestinian dust on his sandals. And when we do just that, we see a man of his time looking and sounding and behaving as a man of his time would be expected to, and he becomes ever more real to us as our perceptions of that shampoo advert Jesus fall away. And my own relationship with him is the more personal because I now see him as a rounded, relatable figure with emotions much like mine. And that has to be a good thing, moving from knowing about him to knowing him.
Thanks for joining us on the Press On podcast. You've been listening to Hazel McAfee. For more, you can visit pressonjournal.org.